Radio Netherlands, not national, but international, broadcasting direct from Northwest Europe. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine with Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, welcome to the launch of a new season of Media Network. Between now and the start of 1996, we'll be taking the program to Tehran, Iran, Johannesburg, South Africa, Quito, Ecuador, and Geneva, Switzerland. For this is the season of broadcasting conferences, and there is clearly a lot on the radio agenda.
Traditionally, it's also the time of the year for a huge influx of mail, and this year's no exception. In the course of this programme, we'll be looking at some traditional technology, and we've got some follow-ups, starting with a quick internet update.
Yes, if you have internet access, then you'll note we have two video clips up on the homepage now, these being the short 30-second commercials used on domestic public television to explain the Dutch service we operate in Europe for those on holiday. At 1.6 megabytes each, these video files are too large for many to download just for 30 seconds of moving pictures. But, on the other hand, Radio Netherlands is determined to keep pushing the frontiers of the internet as far as they will go.
In other words, it's just a bit of fun.
Yes, but I think it's also important to point out that good old-fashioned letters are still welcome too. In fact, our colleagues at Radio Denmark have also decided to expand their presence on the internet. Erik Coy, who is a technical advisor to the station, explains how things are developing.
Yes, we already have started a web page being made in the University of Aarhus. And if you want the address, you can access it by http://www.mi.aau.dk/rdk/.
And what do you see there?
At the moment you only see our schedule. You see some telephone numbers and in Danish only. But of course you can also access our frequency schedule in English.
Are there plans to expand this?
Yes. Also we are hoping to have graphics very shortly. And furthermore, I can tell you that Radio Denmark itself is making a web page, so you can also access the Radio Denmark web pages from around, let's say, Christmas.
Talking about things coming up too, starting next year, Radio Denmark is going to reintroduce English, at least on a small scale to start with.
Yes, on a small scale, but we hope to develop our English program. We will start only once a month, about 15 minutes, and it will be every month on the first Sunday of each month in the last part of the program, of the regular Danish program. So the first one will be on the 7th of January 1996.
And what sort of material and subjects are you going to cover?
We are covering especially the cultural city of 1996, which is Copenhagen.
Does Radio Denmark QSL?
Yes, since the beginning of this year, we have been issuing QSL cards if you enclose one IRC or one US dollar.
Okay, what's the address to write to for indeed the schedule information and also for reception reports?
For snail mail reports, it's Radio Denmark DK 1999. Frederiksberg, C, like Charlie.
In Denmark, of course, and what about that email address again?
The Radio Denmark email address is rdk.ek@login.dknet.dk.
Media Network, Internet Update.
As well as Radio Denmark, we note that Radio Budapest has World Wide Web pages too. The URL is http://www.eunet.hu/radio/. And in the United States, radio amateur and shortwave listener Jim Hawkins has just returned from a tour of the Voice of America transmitter site in Greenville, North Carolina. He's posted some photos of his trip on a worldwide website. The address to type in is this: http://cngj.digex.net/tilde/jimh/radio.html.
There are also pictures of the now defunct VOA site at Bethany in Ohio online. If you're interested in those, then check out Jim Hawkins' radio section. There are 5 pages in total, which also include old broadcast sites in New York State. Nostalgia is in on the World Wide Web.
Talking of good old radio, a lot of international radio stations are facing budget problems these days. That's not really news. But Radio Gamma is facing challenges of a very different kind. Their external broadcasting station in Dakabele, in the eastern part of Uganda, is literally being stripped down by village people stealing cables and angle bars, according to a report monitored by BBC Monitoring. Though the transmitters aren't being used at the moment, they may be modified for use for FM in the future.
Talking of things that can go wrong, according to the brand new World Factbook 1995, published on the internet by the US Central Intelligence Agency, Radio Netherlands and many other shortwave broadcasters are just a bit of virtual fantasy. If you check the country-by-country listings and look at the number of shortwave transmitters in Holland, according to the CIA, the answer is zero. It's zero in Uganda, it's zero in Egypt, in India, it's zero in the United States, which makes it difficult to explain the $365 million being put forward by the US Senate at the moment to cover US international broadcasting operations for 1996.
So, have you sent the CIA an email to correct them?
No, not yet. But one of the things we are looking at is expanding the number of media links on our internet pages.
Right, okay, enough of all that. Now, a bit of this.
We return to Africa, even though our correspondent is in Asia. Victor Gunatilica is now back at his monitoring post in Colombo. And I understand, Victor, that there is a country that's just reactivated one of its shortwave transmitters.
Well, I'm quite surprised to hear Radio Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, back on shortwave, rather high frequency, 15435 kilohertz. Their 50 kilowatt shortwave transmitter is back on the air. And I noted from 1230 to 1500 UTC with a very good signal here in Sri Lanka.
Okay, what else is new from that same region?
Well, Zanzibar is also being heard here on 6014.5. That's 6014.5, a fair reception around 15 hours UTC. And also at the same time, 1530, a very good signal from Kenya, the Voice of Kenya, the African service, 6150 kilohertz.
Victor, thanks for the update.
Towards 2000 with Media Network. Here on Radio Netherlands.
Many of the media shows on the wireless these past few weeks have covered the broadcast professionals conference called Towards 2000, held 3 weeks ago in Amsterdam and organised by Radio Netherlands. Just over 200 broadcasters from all over the world attended. Much of the discussion focused on policy and programming matters, but perhaps one of the most fascinating looked at traditional radio technology. Receiver manufacturers were quick to point out that there's a huge existing base of shortwave receivers in the world, as high as 600 million by some estimates, and that some international broadcasters are too quick to dismiss shortwave as out of date. Whilst it's true that the mass media impact of shortwave is limited to a few parts of the world, such as Burma, with a world population now at 5,733 million people and rising at around 1.5% a year, even audiences of a few percent add up to significant numbers. Moreover, international audiences, especially on shortwave, are motivated as well as loyal. So, why aren't there more shortwave listeners? Esmel Huzur is president of Grundig North America, based in Redwood City, California, and believes shortwave broadcasters should simply exploit the infrastructure they already have in place.
My feeling is the genuine reason that the shortwave radio has not, the demand for shortwave radio had not grown as fast is because of lack of dialogue. By that I mean the broadcaster and manufacturers are not talking to each other. Manufacturers likewise have ignored consumers. And again, consequently, you have a structure which do well with some repairs. Consumers want to listen to international radio, and in many cases, the only international connection that can be afforded is through a shortwave radio. Shortwave, DAB, satellite TV, etc. are not mutually exclusive of one another. I remember when I had a few shares of some of the department stores, when Home Shopping Network first came out, I immediately sold them. I thought that's the end of department store, because everything is going to be bought through the television. But you can see Home Shopping Network has gone through three hands, and now the department store's growth is going on. And on that note, I like to say the real power, again, is not in the corridors of corporate America, of Senate, or Parliament. It is in this room among you international broadcasters. Thank you.
Richard McLaughlin is Managing Director of Low Electronics, a British company which has carved a profitable niche for itself by building radios for the specialist shortwave listener market. Richard explained that it all began in the late 1980s when they saw a market for a simple-to-operate tabletop set.
The Japanese approach to radios, receiving radios certainly, was to pile ever more and more gimmicks in terms of multiple memories and flashing lights and alarm clocks and all sorts of things. And we felt that there was a market for a product where the money would be spent primarily on the technical design and the performance of the product rather than all the flashing lights and gizmos. We started a small factory. We are still only a pretty small company. There's only 25 people in total in the company. We have now found ourselves in 1995 in a rather different situation, whereas say 5 years ago nearly everything we sold was imported from the Far East. Now something like 20 or 30% of what we sell is imported from the Far East, and our own manufactured product probably forms about just under a third to a half of our total output. We're in a price bracket rather at a different point to Grundig. We have about three models, and they sell to the end user at prices between sort of $600 and $1,200 US dollars. We often wonder what proportion of our listeners buy, or our customers buy, radios to listen to the program, and what proportion actually buy it for the sake of finding the program and then, having found it and written it down, go on to the next one. And we do sell quite large volumes of the books that Esmail mentioned, WRTH, PWBR, and things like that, which are aimed almost entirely at the broadcast listener. So I would suspect that a goodly proportion of our listeners do actually buy a radio to listen to it rather than play with it. A surprising number, particularly in the UK, funnily enough, will buy our receivers specifically to listen to aircraft crossing the Atlantic and no other purpose. And a lot of our customers nowadays demand the more complex things, such as decoding software packages. All of our receivers now have the ability to do external computer control. That is almost a requirement in our end of the market. Geographically, probably because we're primarily a UK-based company, about 20% of our output is still sold into the UK. We have a very strong market in Western Europe, primarily in Benelux and Germany. Something like 60% of our output goes there. Why? I don't really know, but it does. Our market grew very fast in 1992, 1993. It has tailed off, the growth rate has tailed off in the last year, probably because our principal product has been sort of gone through its major part of its life cycle curve. We've just introduced a new product. Like Ismail, things like the Gulf War make a very, very big difference, we find, to our market. In the UK, you could not buy a shortwave radio during the period of the Gulf War. ¶¶
Media Network's Asian media correspondent Victor Gunatilaka emphasized the growing technology gulf between developing and developed parts of the world, and he had some startling statistics.
In Sri Lanka and India, the figures are one television set per 28 people. In Nepal, 500 people, one television set. Can you imagine how many computers there would be? Most of the world, they live on less than $100 a month. Would it be reasonable to expect that as the year 2005 comes around, that the use of internet will come down so much that for $2 I will be able to use internet? Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, I think, 100 years ago. But still, in India, one telephone for 88 people. Just before I left, my telephone was out of order. Even last night, I couldn't get through to my home. That's the situation in the third world. So sometimes when we hear the words, shortwave is dead, we wonder whether we have all died in the third world.
In many technological programs broadcast in the last 2 months, there's been quite a lot of hype connected with the development of a clockwork radio. The British inventor Trevor Bayliss came to the Towards 2000 conference to explain why he tackled the problem of building a cheap-to-run radio for African listeners. He was sitting at home watching a television program about the spread of AIDS in Africa.
Now, the person then went on to say that the problem was that of education. How were they going to possibly educate the mass of people? Victor will tell you that you can't get the newspaper in the village. People, most of the people in the villages, in fact, are illiterate. Getting the information out was best solved by the use of the radio. Radio was by far the easiest means of communicating to people. You could give them this valuable sex education by the use of this means. Now, I'm a very, very rich kid, really. Well, kid, 58. Death is my next big event. Anyway, I live on a delightful island in the middle of the River Thames. All right, Victor, you listen to this, all right, mate? I've got a swimming pool in my back lounge. I've got a delightful studio where I play out my fantasies.
It was there, in the workshop, that Trevor decided to work on a problem that faces many listeners in the developing world, namely the exorbitant cost of batteries. He decided to look for an alternative: power generated from a spring.
What I did was to take a conventional spring, known to most people as a logarithmic spring. It's one of those springs you associate with the old clockwork toys. You wind the thing up and it gets progressively harder, as you know. And I found that, in fact, there was only a limited capacity I could get onto that spring. So the next thing I did then was to start looking at a system of producing power in a different type of spring. I started using a spring called a constant force spring. The best way to describe to you a constant force spring is one of those tape measures that you pull out. You know, you pull the tape out and it flies back into the hole. Now, if you were to take that tape out and now roll it in an opposite direction around another drum, if you release that tape, then the other drum would rotate. This is the principle of the constant force spring. A constant force spring delivers the same force when it's stretched to its fullest as when it's to its least.
He tried several combinations of gears connected to a tiny electric generator.
So what I did then was to obtain a constant force spring, which I put into this box. This is the first of my clockwork radios. Very primitive. You see, it's made from bits of old plastic. And then once I got this combination together, I was able then very simply with a Zener diode to join my little electric motor to my transistor radio, limiting the power through the Zener diode that was needed to my radio. So that then was my first radio. Now, I don't know whether it's going to work in here, this place acts like a Faraday cage. If we... Hang on, have we got a bit of noise in?
Hey, you natuurlijk niet. Daarvoor hebben ze een aparte...
There we are, getting sound. What's got me? So there was my first clockwork radio. What is actually happening is the spring is unwinding and then sound is coming out of my radio. Okay? Now, this thing will have to run down now. Now, that wasn't a very efficient machine. I was getting something like a 2-minute wind would give me 14 minutes of sound. But it was a beginning.
Trevor Bayliss publicized his invention in the hope that receiver manufacturers would build radios around his clockwork generator. He was very disappointed that initially there was not only no interest, but a hostile reaction from the scientific community. He recalls getting one letter from a Mr. Ormston Chant.
Anyway, Mr. Ormston Chant then trotted out. He said, I understand spring technology very well. My father was a master clockmaker. And then he went on, and he proved to me scientifically on this letter, right, that I couldn't make my radio work unless the spring weighed 100 weight. Now, I was totally confused now, you see, because...
The alternative, it was ironically suggested, was to use a thermocouple.
A thermocouple, right, is the thing. When you apply heat to it, it generates in a measure of electricity. Now, Mr. Ormston Chant carefully considered this one, and he thought, if I stuck a thermocouple up my backside, maybe I could run a transistor radio. Now, can you believe it? I suppose you could conceal the wires, couldn't you? So we have a new element that's added to this whole equation. It's called humiliation. The next thing that happened was that the Overseas Development Administration got on board. They gave me 143,000 quid to make it happen. So bully to the government, right? They made it happen. They turned this old crate here into this thing here, right? The next thing that happened is out of Africa, out of a radio broadcast, I managed to get Liberty Life of South Africa on board to give me 750,000 quid. Now they then were able to get together a factory for me in which to make my products. Now this is the most exciting thing of all. And this is because I was a creator of about 200 products for the disabled. This fellow from Liberty Life was able to put together a factory employing 150 disabled people making my clockwork radio.
We checked with the factory in South Africa and discovered that full-scale production starts on October 9th. There are plans to expand further too.
We're going to be going and opening up in India, manufacturing there, manufacturing in China. In fact, since that show, the QED program, so many people have come on board now that I cannot manufacture these things fast enough and get them out fast enough. Now, what I'll do then to conclude, to let the other guys get a look in, is I'll put this thing on and hope that we can get some sound back to the Faraday cage. If I put this over here, now we just hope. All right, shall we chance? Now you see, there's the wind-up mechanism on the side here. It's a simple key, and there's a little switch. Which one is it? No, that's the... Now that radio there, for a 20-second wind, gives you 40 minutes of playing time. We're doing things that will run for an hour and a half, but you must expect to wind it for at least 35 seconds. There we are. Now, the extraordinary thing is that when we went to Africa, we thought everybody would want a small rodeo, you know, small, neat, and powerful, and so on. But in fact, no, that's what they, quite the contrary. They wanted big and loud, right?
It was clear by playing with the sample at the Towards 2000 conference that Trevor Bayliss has got the generator principle all sorted out. What's not clear at this point is the quality of the radio portion. We have a production sample in order. The hand-built version that Trevor brought with him looked very different from early publicity photographs. But all the clockwork radios made so far have one thing in common. They all have a shortwave band.
We are going to have them available in Britain. Harrods, would you believe? we're going to make the rich pay for the poor. They don't know that yet. We reckon you can get 6,000... We reckon 6,000 hours out of this particular spring. This is a mechanical device, and it, like your motor car, the spring will break and the gears will wear out. But we reckon we can get 6,000 hours out of it. But then you don't scrap your radio. You take this thing apart, and you've got a cassette containing that engine, which you send back to us, and we replace with like for like. So that the radio, I don't think, will ever give you problems. The modern radio is such a sophisticated piece of kit. But what we've done is we've married old tech with new tech. Now, the nice thing about the old tech is that you can understand it. I would say the reason why the early 1950s motor car is so successful in India is because when you open a bonnet, you can fix it. If it breaks, you can fix it. You buy a modern car, all you've got is a management system. It costs you 600 quid. And it won't start until the specialist comes in. With this, it's the same low-tech technology. If you can understand it, then you should be able to fix it. You've got to remember, this is the first machine. And we are limited because we only put £1 million into it, right? Now, that sounds a lot of money, but when you're developing and creating products and creating work and building factories, ain't a lot of beans.
So much for the clockwork wireless.
But I think it will be some time before they make a clockwork television. Talking of which, Veronica Television, which went commercial just over a month ago, has been in the news here because of disappointing viewing figures, a 9% share instead of the expected 13%. Veronica chairman Joop van der Rijden says they plan to reduce the number of American series to try and increase the share and suppress calls from advertisers for a lower rate or other forms of compensation. Meantime, Veronica Radio is one of the few stations in Europe you can actually see performing on television. Between 05 and 15 hours UTC, Veronica Television, which is on the Astra satellite system, is broadcasting pictures from a fixed camera in the hit radio Veronica studio. The TV sound is in parallel with what's broadcast on 1224 and 828 kHz. Veronica's press office claims that 14,000 people watch radio being made on television in this way. However, it's only rare that the radio disc jockeys actually play to the camera.
Well, down in New Zealand, Arthur Cushion's been watching the sale of the commercial network that used to be public. What about the details?
Yes, the commercial service of Radio New Zealand is up for sale. It's now being tendered by the Treasury Department. Already there are 12 interested parties, two Australian networks, and considerable interest in the sale of the 40 stations. Of those 40 stations, there are 13 known as community stations. In the past, as you would imagine, government have pleased little areas and given them their own radio station, and over the years they haven't been a viable proposition but have been part of the network. And there's 13 of those stations which the government are trying to protect so that there is some local involvement, and they're trying to get people to invest in their local radio station. The public radio, which is the non-commercial side of broadcasting here, has now got a charter similar to the ABC and BBC. It runs for 5 years. They have a guaranteed income of $19.4 million annually. That comes from our broadcasting fee. We pay $110 New Zealand for broadcasting and television listening. And the government have also indicated $7 to $10 million will be put aside for capital expenditure. The word Radio New Zealand and Radio New Zealand News is a now protected item, and Radio New Zealand International becomes part of public radio, something like the things that happened in Canada. It was part of the Minister of Foreign Affairs and been put back to Radio New Zealand, just like in Canada where they put it back to the CBC just in March. So it's got a fairly assured future as far as non-commercial Radio New Zealand goes.
And there's a quick frequency change to pass on.
1615 to 1850, it's 5960. Then for an hour between 1850 and 1950, there are 9655, and then they resume the old schedule and move to 11735.
Arthur, thanks for the update.
Now to Mike Burt's propagation bit on the wireless. Mike.
Diana, late on Wednesday the 27th and last Thursday, the magnetic field became quite disturbed. It also became stormy yesterday. Solar activity was low all week. The solar flux ranged between 74 and 71. The average works out to 72.7, which equals an effective sunspot number of 8, and that's down 3 points on the previous week's level. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the estimated planetary A index, ranged between 45 and 3, which represents minor storm to quiet conditions. The magnetic field became active late on Wednesday the 27th, and these conditions lasted until midday on Thursday. The cause was a coronal hole, which has lain dormant for the last 10 solar rotations. From Friday through to Monday, the magnetic field was mostly quiet. Tuesday saw the magnetic field reach active levels again, and then yesterday it reached minor storm thresholds.
And what about between now and next Thursday, October 12th?
IPS Radio and Space Services expect solar activity will remain low. The geomagnetic field should continue to be active today. Hopefully tomorrow will quieten, but on Sunday through to Wednesday, we are expecting more active levels with minor storming at times.
Mike, thanks for the warning.
And that's all for now. From Jonathan and myself, have a pleasant weekend.